Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Robert Spitzer. He's Distinguished Service Professor at State University of New York at Cortland and the author of The Politics of Gun Control, a topic on which he's written widely, including a recent piece in The Washington Post. The name and voice may also be familiar to some listeners because of his regular appearance on WCNY's The Ivory Tower Half Hour. Bob, welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you, Grant.
Well, let's start nationally with what was and what perhaps might be again, the National Assault Weapons Ban of 1994, which expired in 2004. And the story here in New York State is more complicated, and we'll get into that a bit later. But first, with this piece of legislation, some of the provisions of that ban, which many have been calling for bringing back again, were cosmetic in nature, having to do with how the gun looked more than how it functioned, as long as it wasn't a fully automatic weapon. And the provisions of that, as I understand it, were grandfathered to apply to weapons and high-capacity clips that were manufactured after 1994. So what were the provisions of that law and that approach that would be most relevant to tragedies like Sandy Hook or Aurora?
Yeah, a lot of discussion about assault weapons, of course, because the chief proposal that's being bandied about for action by Congress in the weeks and months to come is to renew some version of the assault weapons ban. And that law, that law was criticized both from the left and the right. Gun owners and the gun rights community felt that it was a frivolous piece of legislation to the extent that assault weapons do, as you suggest, have a series of traits that really do seem to be cosmetic as compared with many varieties of traditional hunting weapons, hunting rifles, because the firing mechanism for both is semi-automatic, meaning that if a bullet fires each time you pull the trigger, and as fast as you can pull the trigger, that's how many bullets you can fire. There's also some confusion. Some people talk about automatic weapons, meaning fully automatic weapons, and those have been strictly regulated since the 1930s, and that they are not in general circulation. An example of an effective gun law, by the way, I would point out, that's been successful for many decades. So these are semi-automatic weapons. However, they do have military origins, very specifically arising from the weapon that the Soviets developed towards the end of World War II, the famous AK-47. And in the 1980s, the American market became flooded with Chinese-made assault-style weapons that were essentially copies of the Russian AK-47, and they became more popular. But they were designed specifically for combat use. That is to say, they were lighter weight, had shorter barrels, had thumb holes that facilitated what was called spray fire, that is to lay down a field of fire, not pinpoint accuracy, but to fire lots of bullets rapidly over a wide area. And the 1994 law stipulated that weapons that possess two or more of these traits would be categorized as assault weapons. And the law listed 18 or 19 named brands and then several dozen copycat models that were prohibited to be sold or owned. And you're right that they weapons of this nature that had been manufactured before 1994 were exempted from the law. In terms of the effect of the law, it's been pretty roundly criticized for not being effective. Certainly, there was no connection between any drop in crime and the assault weapons ban. However, there were some studies which have not gotten much attention conducted during the 1990s, which came to the conclusion that assault weapons were used less in gun crimes during this period of time. Now, that suggests that people using guns probably were substituting other guns for assault weapons, and most guns used in crimes are handguns, and that continues to be true. That has not changed over many, many decades. But the idea is that a weapon that has greater firepower, that has a higher muzzle velocity, so the bullet leaves at a very, very fast rate, and that can receive bullet magazines that hold a lot of bullets, so you don't have to reload as often, that these ought not to be in civilian hands and that there's really no argument for allowing them to be in civilian hands, certainly not for hunting or other purposes. But the law lapsed, and for the gun community, it was good riddance.
Well, I want to pick up on something that you mentioned there about the handgun issue. And and think about this. As tragic as the Sandy Hook shootings were, as you and others have pointed out, and you just did again, most people die from gun violence in other ways. And gun rights advocates have pointed out, for example, that in 2011, looking at New York State, only 5 of the 769 homicides were committed by an assault rifle. So let's take one piece of that that's particularly relevant, I think, for us here in central New York, which is gang-related violence, which is a big factor in Syracuse City's murder rate. How would an assault weapons ban approach help that problem?
Well, it wouldn't. I mean, to be blunt, except perhaps for the handful of cases that you mentioned. And that gets to one of the underlying issues about gun violence versus assault weapons. And it's the very point you're making, that if you look at gun injuries, gun deaths across the country every year, let's put it this way. There are twice as many long guns as handguns in America, and long guns are easier to get in most places.
When you say long gun, we're talking about basically what most of us would think of as a rifle or a shotgun.
Exactly right. And that would include long-barreled assault weapons as well.
Okay.
However, 80% of gun crimes are committed with handguns. So there's no question that handguns are really the chief issue when it comes to the use of guns in crime. And most people who obtain guns get them for hunting and sporting purposes, and by and large, those are not handguns. The chief reason civilians obtain handguns for themselves, they say, is for personal self-protection, which is something that is protected under federal court rulings. So criminologically speaking, handguns are the big problem. But assault weapons have been weapons of choice for many of these very sensational shootings. I mean, in absolute numbers, it's a small number, just as the number of school shootings actually is, you know, statistically very, very small. But it raises the question of whether and why civilians should be able to obtain easy access to weapons that have such firepower and that give the shooter the ability to fire off 30 rounds, 50 rounds, 100 rounds, or even more without reloading. And it's hard to – frankly, it's hard to marshal any argument on behalf of allowing civilians to have those weapons. And that takes you then back to the assault weapons ban.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with gun control expert Robert Spitzer, a professor at SUNY Cortland. Let me stick with this handgun issue and ask you a more specific question about that. Like a lot of thorny political issues, I think this is going to come down to where the compromise point will be found between groups and members of the public with pretty different views on the matter. So I wanted to throw out one possibility and just get your sense of, is this kind of beyond the pale of compromise, or is this something that we might imagine actually happening? Thinking about the handguns here, what about a complete ban on certain kinds of handguns that are most amenable to high-capacity clips, such as the 9mm? Is that something that could happen at the national level politically or not?
I don't think so, and it's not really what's being discussed right now. I think that would be for gun control advocates, I think that would be a bridge too far. Any notion of – and also any notion of confiscation, that is of taking guns from people who currently own them legally, I think meets with – when you look at polls, meets with great resistance, obviously among gun owners, but also some suspicion among some groups of people who are not gun owners but who have certain belief that, look, if you're doing something legally, you're allowed to do it under the law. I might not be – comfortable with you having a gun or owning it, but there's a certain live and let live quality that says, you know, I'm not sure I am comfortable with disturbing the public order to the degree of the government requiring people to turn in guns that they currently own legally. That whole notion, I think, is beyond the pale for a variety of reasons in the American political context.
What about another aspect of this in terms of, is this within the pale of possible compromise or outside of it? A change in the firearm application process such that it becomes extremely difficult to get a handgun permit or to get a permit to own one of these military-style rifles, meaning, say, when I say extreme, something like only 5 or 10% of the applicants are approved.
Well, if you look at the 50 states, because that's where this occurs, I mean, you could implement a national law, but we do have models in the states. And about 40 of America's 50 states have a pretty permissive permit system. As a matter of fact, four states have recently abolished handgun permitting entirely. That is to say, you can obtain a handgun in four states, Arizona, Alaska, Vermont, and I think Wyoming is the fourth state, where you can simply obtain a gun and no government permitting is involved. And government laws at the state level have become more permissive in recent years. There's the influence of the National Rifle Association, I would say. But in all, minus those four states, you've got another 36 states where obtaining a permit to have a handgun is pretty easy. It's like a driver's license. You fill out a form, and as long as you're not disqualified by either being a felon or mentally unbalanced, you can get the permit and therefore get a gun. And those are called shall-issue states. Mm. About 8 or 10 states are may-issue states, and New York State is one, where it's a permitting process. But it's a more rigorous process. And here in New York State, it's really a multi-stage process. Aside from paying fees, like various kinds of fees to underwrite the cost, you have to submit an application. You have to list four references of people who can speak on your behalf. And the police will talk to those people and ask about you. They will also ask for secondary references, your fingerprinted, you're photographed, and you have to give a reason for why you want a permit. You cannot just say as a matter of right, I want it. Mm-hmm. That is, you have to give a reason, and then it's up to the discretion of a judge or magistrate to decide whether you get it. Now, even so, a great many New Yorkers have lawful pistol permits for various purposes. But that kind of process has one significant advantage, which is it would provide a pretty broad opportunity for authorities to flag and identify people who may be having significant problems. I mean, if you look at the mass shootings in the last 30 years, there have been some studies done by journalistic organizations. A majority of them, in recent years, had clearly identifiable mental problems well known to friends and family. And had any law enforcement officer asked, you know, the friends or family of these people, well, look, you know, are there any problems? It would have been immediately clear that they were not entitled to have these weapons and to have the right to have the weapons. And in fact, 80% of mass shooters obtained their guns legally. So that underscores what I think is really the gaping hole in this process nationwide and in most places.
Well, this issue of the access to the guns, thinking about the shooter in Newtown, he got the guns from his mother, and some have proposed that when a family member is shown to have certain mental diagnoses, that access to guns then not only need to be prohibited to that person, but you know, from the entire family or that household. So that idea seems like it would be very complicated and messy to enforce at the family level. How would you craft a policy like that so that it would be acceptable and it could work?
There's already a working precedent. In 1995, Congress enacted a law that said people who are subject to a domestic restraining order, let's say there's a case of domestic violence, local police can go in and remove guns from the home if there's a restraining order for somebody based on domestic violence concerns. So that is already in a federal law and I think provides a ready kind of approach that could certainly be used. And I think the case of the shooter in Connecticut is an exemplar of that because he was living in the home and his mother didn't own the guns legally. But you could easily craft a law that would cover those kinds of circumstances.
So would you extend that then to other family members? I mean, how broad could you take something like that and make it workable? Would you have to limit it to the household?
I think the definition would be the household, sure. In other words, if you have a relative, even a close relative, but who lives in a different location and who owns guns legally, I think that you would have to draw a line at that point because you couldn't reach out to other family members or close friends even if they live in different places.
And I want to pursue the avenue that we discussed before the break and the broaden the consideration of this a bit and think about the gun violence issue in comparison with other realms of life and policy. And I go back to your editorial in the Washington Post. You pointed out that the number of suicides by gun at about 18,000 per year is far higher than the number of people killed by someone else with a gun, which is about 11,500 per year, and that the presence of guns makes suicide attempts much more lethal than other kinds of attempts. Well, that taps into the emphasis on keeping guns away from certain people because of the greater risk of harm, in this case, to themselves. And we were just talking about that with this idea of limiting the guns in certain households. But all of this got me thinking, this kind of approach to different realms of activity. So let me share these questions with you. They may seem a bit strange, but I want to just get your reactions to them as I was sitting there sort of puzzling over this. First, about 10,000 people are killed every year by drunk drivers. We sometimes take their driver's license away from those folks. But why is a person with a drunk driving conviction allowed to purchase alcohol or to live in a home with alcohol?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. I guess the notion is that alcohol use intersects with automobiles to a pretty small degree. That is to say, because you can consume alcohol in your home or other places, it doesn't automatically bring you into the motor vehicle and yield a situation where you might be engaging in drunk driving. But notice also that in the last 30 or 40 years, the country has engaged in an intensive public relations campaign and other laws that have been enacted as well to discourage drunk driving. And in fact, drunk driving rates have dropped by about 2/3 in the last 40 years or so. Intensive campaigns saying, it's wrong to drive after you've had alcohol. Legal liability issues arise for those who sell or give alcohol to people who then do drive drunk. So public policy has marshaled various ways to try and dampen that behavior, short of banning it entirely. And also, guns have a unique trait that isn't shared by others, which is they have only one purpose, and that is to maim and destroy. They have no other manifest purpose. And alcohol is used, let's say, in many, many situations where there is not necessarily any connection to the kinds of terrible behavior that the society does move to try and deter.
Well, the connection, though, that I was thinking of, I guess, was here's someone, though, in the hypothetical case I gave you, who's already been convicted. And so in a sense, it does seem similar to the gun issue in the sense that you give that person the alcohol and you say, but don't drive, in the same way that, in a sense, the counterargument is, you focus on what people do with the guns, not whether they have the guns. Here are a couple others, too, but you've kind of already anticipated this, I think. These are other examples. Why do we allow someone who crashed their car while texting to own a smartphone? They've already demonstrated that they're going to misuse that. Why do we allow a convicted child pornographer to own a personal computer? They've already demonstrated that. Yeah. There's going to be a problem there. Yeah. So it got me thinking about that. But I don't know if you have any further reactions to sort of different realms of our life. It seems to me there are some things in society that more generally we value, the personal computer, the smartphone, and we just don't want to get into regulating that, and we just don't want to go there.
Yeah, and it's difficult in public policy making across many areas to have a single uniform bright line rule that applies uniformly across these many areas. Part of it is pure pragmatism, the proliferation of cell phones in America, the proliferation of guns in America. I think our attitudes towards gun control would be very, very different if instead of 300 million guns in America, there were 30 million guns in America. So that background fact has a lot to do with how we react to the issue. And it's the inherent complexity of public policymaking, of the state doing its primordial job of protecting the lives, health, and safety of its citizens. But how far does the government go? When does it become a nanny state? And, I have no wise, simple answer to how that can be parsed for many different issues.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm speaking with Robert Spitzer, an expert on gun control. Well, let's look at New York very specifically now and think about what's likely or possible at the state level. As you have already mentioned, New York is already one of the stricter states in terms of gun laws. It essentially kept in effect the assault weapons ban. You've described the permitting process for handguns as being pretty thorough. But nonetheless, there have been a spate of proposals now that have come out in light of the most recent tragedy. And the Senate Majority Leader, Dean Scalise, recently brought forward a package of proposals, and the theme of those was increasing the penalties for crimes that are already on the books for acts involving guns. The governor, in his State of the State address, made it very clear that he wants to push for something much further than that, some kind of ban on the sale of assault weapons and high-capacity clips, regardless of when they were made. The DA's Association has proposed other similar restrictive laws that include eliminating grandfather clauses. So which of these approaches is going to be best, and what do you anticipate actually happening here in the state of New York?
Well, Governor Cuomo has made a new assault weapons ban a high priority and related gun regulations. New York does have an assault weapons ban on the books. It was enacted in the year 2000. But I guess there are I haven't looked at the details of that law in some time. It is not as comprehensive as Cuomo would like. He clearly wants to move ahead on this, and I think this will be an early test of his leadership and also of the flexibility or inflexibility of the state Senate to accede to the wishes of the Democratic majority in the Assembly and also the Democratic governor. I think Cuomo will wind up with something because I think his hand is pretty strong. I think there's a lot of pressure on the state Senate to yield to some degree. There probably will be strengthened penalties along the lines that Dean Skelos has talked about. But I think it's likely that Cuomo will get at least significant parts of his gun control agenda.
And if he does get, in a sense, a big political victory there and gets most of what he wants, is there any danger for his possible presidential ambitions? In a sense, he goes too far as where the nation is comfortable being.
Yeah, Governor Cuomo has been mentioned often as a possible presidential contender in 2016. But he's already crossed a line, I think, in terms of how he has defined his own politics. I mean, he pushed through the state legislature, for example, the gay marriage law, and that was really kind of a signal, classically liberal achievement. So, and in terms of social issues, he's marked himself out as a social liberal but a fiscal conservative. And I think that's his formula, his political formula. I think that's just what he wants to take to national politics should he decide to take that step. And his beliefs on gun control, I think, are quite consistent with his past policy stance on similar issues.
Let me get to the three questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
I couldn't be having a better time.
Second, what's your worst trait?
Hard for me to let things go that I should let go.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
The fact that a guy like you would be interested in talking to a guy like me.
That was Professor Robert Spitzer. Bob, thanks so much for talking with me.
It's been a great pleasure.
We'll be continuing our conversation about gun control next week when my guest will be Onondaga County District Attorney Bill Fitzpatrick. Join me again then for more conversation in the public interest.